chair?
Okay.
Okay. You ready? Gentlemen, firstly, thank you to all the chair carriers. In light of recent events, before we start with the specific material and shiur, I wanted to give sort of a general introduction to issues I think that we need to be very well aware of. The Gemara in Bava Kamma, Daf Lamed Amud Aleph, says that Hayman Deboy in the Meve Chasida, someone wants to be truly pious, Likayim Mili Dinezikin. He has to be Mekayim, those found the words of Nezikin. Maseches Nezikin is Bava Kamma, Bava Metzia, Bava Basra. Rava Amre Mili De Avos, he says those things of Pirkei Avos. Va Amrila, different version of Rava Mili De Brachos. Our purpose in life, from the perspective of Yados, our primary purpose is to create Kiddush Hashem in everything we do. There is no higher halachic value. Some of you may, of course, immediately object, you know, to the Gimel Atheros, that a person is to be Moser Nefesh for, besides Chilul Hashem. But if you actually look at the Rambam in Perek Hei of Hilchos Yisodei HaTorah, so one of the things that the Rambam says is that if a person was forced to violate one of the Gimel Averos, even though he's supposed to be Moser Nefesh, if he failed to be Moser Nefesh, he doesn't violate the Aver in question. He doesn't violate Gila Rayos, he doesn't violate Avodah Zarah. Why? Because he's onus on Gila Rayos, he's onus on Avodah Zarah. So that one, what then does he violate? So the Rambam says he violates the Chilata Hashem Hashem Elokecha. You violate Chilul Hashem. There's nothing more significant, there's nothing worse that a Ben Torah can do than create a Chilul Hashem. You've heard the expression Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah. The origin of this expression, as best as I can tell, is a passage in Vayikra Rabbah. The Medrash says there, tells a very interesting story. Some of you may have heard the story. It's a very powerful story. Rav Yanai had a guest. So he invited this person into his house. So he says, he gives him a meal, and he says to him, he gives him bachina. He doesn't know any chumash. He doesn't know any Mishnah. He doesn't know anything. So finally he says, Sav brich. Go make brich hasamatan. I'm do something. Amar le yivarech Yanai bebeisei. Let Yanai make the bench in his house. Amar le. So Rav Yanai sees he doesn't know the bench either. So he says, Amar le, is bach, Amar ma dan amar lach, can you repeat after me? So Amar le, so he said, I'll repeat the bracha after you. Amar le emor, he said to him, say the following, Achul kalba piste di Yanai. A dog ate from the food of Yanai. Kam tafse, the guy gets up and grabs him by the neck. Amar le, yiruta siga bach da anoneli. You have my Yerusha. You're holding it back from me. Amar le ma yiruta seich, what is your Yerusha? What is your Yerusha that you're thinking that I have? Amar le chadznan havina avar kame be safra. One time I was passing by the Beis Sefer. Ushma is kolin demenikaya. Amrin toratzi valano Moshe morashal ki las Yaakov. Morashal ki las Yanai ein sivkan, ela ki las Yaakov. You have my heritage. So Amar Le, Rajanai asks him, Lama Zachisa Lamechla al Psuri. What was your merit that you got to eat on my Shulchan? Some might have said after what Rajanai did that wasn't such a merit. Amar Le, Miyomai lo Shmais mi labisha lachazarti lamara. I never once heard somebody say something bad and went back, was Rochel and told the person who spoke. Velo Chamis trained in Iskanshin Dain and Dain, two people gathered together fighting below Yahavish Shalama Beinehon. So he says to him, Amar le kol hadad derech eretz gabach v'karisa kalba. You have such bal derech eretz and I called you a dog. So he goes on to talk about a little more, and then finally he says, l'shmar is derech eitz hachayim, derech zo derech eretz. V'achar kach eitz hachayim zo Torah. The I think Tana de Ben Leo comments that Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah 26 generations. the message here is that first, before you're a ben Torah, you're a human being. Before you have relate to studying Torah, relating just to other Jews, you have to relate to being a human being and relating to all other human beings in a certain fashion. If you can't do that, then you shouldn't be learning Torah. The way Rabbah put it to his Talmidim, the Gemara and Yoma, is that those who don't have Yirah Shamayim, why do you torture yourself in this world and the next world? Because if you don't have Yirah Shamayim, even though you're at Sofer Mei Rabbanan, so a chelik in the next world you're not going to get, so why should you suffer in this world as well? This, to me, perhaps is the most important thing that I would like to see my Talmidim at least represent. I don't care about the Lundus, and I do care about it some, but it's not the most important thing. There are a lot of things that I think are important, but they're all of secondary importance to the impression you make on people who look at you and what they say about you as a person, not whether you're a fine London and whether you got the Reb Chaim or you got the Yerushalmi or the Tosef or whatever it is. The first thing is how you treat each other. One of the things a student commented to me, and I don't take this as a reflection upon myself, but for reflection, for whatever reason, on some of the Talmidim that I had, is that the guys in the shir are really nice. And that's really, really important. You all know the story of Rabbi Akiva and his Talmidim, and Rabbi Akiva found the one Talmud who was sick, and nobody was taking care of him, and he had to take care of him. But it's your responsibility to look after each other also. Not just how you treat each other, how you treat everybody around, but start by some of the most basic things that many people miss. The people who work in this institution, the guards when you walk in the morning. They have a job, it's not always an easy job. I've seen students behave in a way that's totally, totally inappropriate. They may ask you for your ID some of the time they don't. Don't give them a hard time. You say good morning when you walk in. I see people walk in on a regular basis, it's as if the person isn't even sitting there. It's just not derech eretz. It's not the way you behave. The way you act towards professors. Sometimes this is less common, but you see students, you know, behave in ways that to me are just staggering. The way you treat administrators. And again, it doesn't mean that these people are always right, but there's a certain kind of derech eretz that's absolutely necessary. One other issue that I generally feel I shouldn't have to talk about. Is there another chair? What's that? Check on the fifth floor. It's an issue that some of you have been with me already know a little bit that it's a particular issue of mine. But the issue of academic integrity. Some of you are returning, some of you graduated, okay, but some of you are returning, some of you are new on campus. educate yourself to what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. And don't be afraid to ask a shaila. And when you ask a shaila, the purpose is not looking for a loophole, but actually finding out what's appropriate, what's inappropriate. But you should be very well aware. You should be very well aware of what the rules are and what is considered appropriate and what is not. Because chas v'shalom, if you make an error, even when it's an error, and you get dragged in front of the panel, frequently if you know some of the members of the panel in the college will be B'nai Torah from people, some of them will be non-Jewish, some of them will be non-from Jews, the Chilul Hashem is tremendous. And Echad Shogeg V'Echad Mezid B'Chilul Hashem. So make sure you know what is acceptable, what is not acceptable. The Yeshiva College puts out a pamphlet. I assume most of you, even those of you who are new on campus, they probably gave it out orientation. I hope they did. If not, make sure you get a hold of it. They have copies, I know, outside the dean's office. It's one of the most important things. When people trample on those grounds, it makes the entire morning absolutely worthless. There's no point in being here. There's no point being engaged in learning. It's not a minor thing. I would just close with a comment about a Gemara that many of you know. Some of you might have learned it if you learned a Masechta, if you bar mitzvah, Makos is a very popular Masechta to learn, obviously, because it's fairly short. And the Gemara at the end of Makos starts a progression of principles of Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu was given Taryag Mitzvos. And then each subsequent figure in the Medrash whittles down the number of requirements or number of basic core principles of the Torah. And I'm just going to read to you three of them. One of them is a very famous Mizmor in Tehillim. But you should think about what exactly identifies the essential characteristics. Mizmor l'David Hashem mi'agur ba'ohalecha mi'ishkon b'har kodshecha. Holech tamim ufoel tzedek v'dover emes bilvavov. Lo ragal alashono, it's not a talebearer, lo asal l're'ehu ra'ah, v'cherpala nasal krovo. Nivzeh be'enav nim'as, v'esirei Hashem yichabed, nishpa l'harav lo yamir. He keeps to his word. Kaspola nasan b'neshech, v'shochad al makilo lakach, oseh ele lo yimot le'olam. There isn't a single thing in this list, maybe one, not even that, which could be qualified as a mitzvah which has been adam lamakom. Every single thing in this list is a basic principle of human ethics. When you go a step further, I believe it was Micha, who reduced it to three. Some of you may know the three. It was asos mishpat, v'ahavas chesed, v'hatznei alecha sim elokecha. To do that which is just, to do justice, to love kindness, and v'hatznei aleches means to walk humbly with humility, with modesty. Modesty is not about the length of clothing, as some people misunderstand. That's a din in what we call erva. It has different applications. A tsanua is a person who doesn't seek to attract attention to himself. These are basic human ethical principles. And finally, the last one, which is most telling, because you get everything distilled down to one principle, is v'tzadik be'emunaso yichya. To the best of my knowledge, emunah does not mean what it means in modern and medieval Hebrew. Emunah in modern and medieval Hebrew means faith. It's not what it means. I mean, the words are semantically related. Kel emunah v'ein avel. God doesn't have emunah. He doesn't have emunah bitachon. Emunah is trustworthiness. If you want to see the way it's described, it's often the contrast of someone who is not yashar versus someone who is emunah, someone who is trustworthy. That is what a ben Torah has to be. That's what a Jew has to be. And without that, all the mitzvos ben adam lamakom, all the lamdas, all the Torah, all the tzitzis and tefillin and mezuzah and tefillah b'tzibur, all of that loses its meaning. So if you learn nothing but that, then I can say dayenu. I mention this, and I start with this for two reasons. Number one, because as I mentioned at the beginning of current events, there have been one too many, one is too many, but there have been far too many Chil Hashems in recent months. For me, it's a source of great pain in the sense that I know that some of these issues are far more widespread than that which has appeared in the media. And whether or not the people who have appeared in the media are actually guilty, whether they're guilty or not, lots of these kinds of things are going on across the firm world. And what causes me great pain is that when I have a contractor come to my house and someone who's not from, who's not Jewish, and he offers not to charge me the sales tax, he's not doing it because his priest, his imam, his rabbi, his whatever else told him that it's okay because he doesn't have to. He's doing it because that particular person is not completely honest. But there are people who walk around and use Torah as their excuse as to why they can behave in a dishonest fashion. And that is another level of Chilul Hashem, which is almost unspeakable. So that's one issue. The second issue is that we're learning Maseches Bava Basra. And whenever you're learning in Yanam of Choshen Mishpat, so it should not just be about the technical lumdus of what you're learning. There's also a very strong ethical dimension to what you're doing. When you learn Hilchos Tzitzis, whether you tie the knots this way or if you tie the knots that way, so maybe one fulfills the mitzvah and one doesn't, but except for perhaps for the mystics, on a mystical level, on some hidden level, it really fundamentally doesn't matter, except for that if it's God's will to tie it this way, you tie it this way. If it's His will to tie it that way, to tie it that way. Mitzvos lo nitnu ala tzarif b'hanas abrios. But when it comes to Choshen Mishpat, see, there really is another dimension. And we have to think about it. It's not enough simply to get the lumdus, but think about what are the ethical implications and ramifications of particular dinim. In light of that, and sort of moving towards a little bit what I'm planning on doing this year, one day a week, I plan to do halach lemaisa. Halach lemaisa means, in this case, choshen mishpat. It's not always as lemaisa when we did Shabbos, did brachos, or chulin. But what I'm going to be attempting to do, with the help, and some of you know Rabbi Broyd from Atlanta, is sort of putting together or using a little bit of his curriculum, or a sketch of a curriculum, of Dinim and Choshen Mishpat that every frum Jew, Balabatim, and probably Rabbanim also, since most of them haven't learned Choshen Mishpat, need to know. I believe that I will be doing halacha on Sundays, and I will give you more instructions in terms of how to prepare for Shir, but we will sort of be taking different parts of Choshen Mishpat and doing those topics. They are extremely, extremely important. I think that when you deal with things now, you may not see them, you may not realize their value, but when you leave yeshiva in one capacity or another, you will see that they actually are much, much greater importance than one would realize just being a Talmud in the yeshiva. Other than that, we will be spending the rest of the week doing Cheskas Abatim. And in terms of the goal, just to lay out where I'd like to, what I'd like to try to accomplish during the year, I would like to do the entire Perek. It is not really likely that we could do the entire, those of you who know my pace, those who've been here before know that I'm not going to get through the entire Perek in Iyun, but somehow I would like to supplement. I don't intend on taking a day off of Bikias, but somehow I'll try to figure out how to get some of the rest of the Perek in. Perhaps it will not be mandatory, but I'll encourage, you know, those who have some time in Nightshade or whatever else is that they're doing, and I will be happy, you know, maybe to do some kind of chaburas or something like that on occasion to sort of guide along in that regard. If you would like a very good summary of so much that we're going to do this year, if you want a cheat sheet, which may still help you with something of an overview, you could read through the Rambam, Hilchos Toin V'Nitan. I'll explain more about this in a little bit, but really, Prakim test through the end, test through Tezayin. The second half of Toin V'Nitan is really, some of the stuff's not in Cheskas Abatim, but it's really all about Chazakos. When I say Chazakos, I mean demonstration of ownership, whether it be on Karak or Metaltalim. The first two Prakim, I think, Tess and Yudar are on Metaltalim, and the rest of Toin V'Nitan is on Karkos. there is an analogous section of Shulchan Aruch. I don't have the Simanim with me. I think it's around Kuf Lamed to Kuf Mem something, where again it's broken down in Choshen Mishpat by Cheskas Metaltalim, Cheskas Karkos. The focus of the Perek, really, from a conceptual or legal perspective, is a basic issue that any legal system has to grapple with. And that is being able to determine who is the rightful owner of an object. It seems so elementary, but it's actually, it's not elementary. Certainly the devil is in the details. and this is an issue that every legal system has to grapple with. There's a book, which I've read only part of. Lam, you probably read this book, by Boaz Cohn. Roman and Jewish Law. So he mentions there's a code of law, one of the early Roman law codes, the 12 tables, which is supposed to be roughly contemporaneous with Ezra Nehemiah, I think, in which there is a law of chazaka, I think it's karkos, of 2 years. And at least according to what he presents, it's very much similar to the system that's laid out in the Mishnah in terms of a chazaka of a certain period of time, and B, that a chazaka requires a taina. Now, just a comment on this. Were any of you there for Rabbi Reis's shir last week? I don't recall anybody knew who was going to be in the shir there. So Rabbi Reis gave an introduction to Cheskas Abatim, and so one of the things that was helpful for me, because I wouldn't have access to this otherwise, is he mentioned that in American law, there is a notion of squatter's rights, but it takes about 20 years. If you live on a property, I think he said it was 20 years, and uninterrupted, then you become the owner of the property. But that is not chazaka as demonstrating ownership of a property. That is chazaka in actually acquiring a property. When we talk about chazaka, the primary focus of our perek is not about the chazaka through which you acquire things, but the chazaka which provides proof of your ownership of something. So some of you probably know, how are you kona metaltalin? You acquired through chazaka, and what kind of chazaka is metaltalin acquired through? No. That's proof. That's not acquisition. How do you acquire metaltalin? Meshicha, hagba, mesira. Right. Those are forms and effect of chazaka, and that you'll find in the Mishnayos and Kiddushin towards the end of the first parak, or at least the beginning of the second half of the first parak. That's the chazaka of acquisition. How do you acquire karka? Kesef, shtar, and chazaka, which the Gemara says is no'al gadar and paratz, right? You do something that demonstrates ownership. Those are chazakas of acquisition. That is really not our primary focus. There is a part of the perek, and you may have seen a little bit in the Mishnah and Tosefta, that deals with acquiring the properties of a ger, where it's actually a chazaka to acquire, because the ger, it's assuming a ger dies without any heirs. So in that case, all his nechassim become hefker, and you see in a little bit of the Mishnah, and then more in the Tosefta, and the Gemara will have, there's not a lot in the Gemara about it. We'll talk about how one exactly acquires the properties that a ger is left behind, and since a ger has no relatives from before his conversion, and if he has no children, then he has no relatives at all. So that's a chazaka of acquisition. In fact, if you noticed in the Mishnah, when the Mishnah finishes talking about all this chazaka, and then it says, Bamed Varim Amurim, marks the transition from chazaka of proof to chazaka of acquisition, to chazaka of kinyan. There will be, by the way, there is a famous, I believe it's a ktsos, who talks about this issue, whether or not there was such a notion of a chazaka acquisition, a cheska shaloshanim, because there are some funny havaminas in the Gemara. There are a couple of different Gemaras scattered throughout the first half of cheska sabbat, and that raise the possibility that maybe chazaka should be not only a proof, but should actually be a means of acquisition. Namely, that a chazaka that would have no tana, that would have no claim accompanied, a claim of having purchased it, a claim of having been given it, should still be a chazaka. So ultimately, that's not accepted, but that's one of those ideas that's going to be floating, and every time you read the Gemara, you want to think about that a little bit. Okay, so anyway, so that is really the issue we're going to be grappling with, chazaka primarily in karkos, but there's also going to be cheskas metaltlim when you get to the middle of the parak. Before we start on the Mishnayos, just a few words about shir itself. Methodology. Some of you have been here, some of you know anyway, some of you know what you're getting into. If not, maybe you won't be here, but my style, my derech halimut is very, very textual. It's also broad in terms of the text that it's interested in. Mishnah Tosefta is not going to occupy us for more than a few days, but one comment about that. I'm going to talk a little bit about what Tosefta is, because most of you have never, unless you've been in the shir before, have never really done Tosefta. One comment about Mishnah. Most of you have learned Mishnah in some capacity, but when I talk about learning Mishnah, it's important to consider that Mishnah has meaning on its own before you look at the Gemara. It is very, very easy to forget this. We do this most of the time, but the Bavli actually is a commentary on the Mishnah. I know that on the one hand it seems tautological, it seems obvious, but when you learn most of the time Gemara, you often forget that, and you stop thinking about what, especially the Amoraim, are doing to the Mishnah. You read statements and you tend to forget this is really a perish on the Mishnah, and some of the time it doesn't matter, and some of the time you miss what's being said because you don't think in those terms. So we will read at least initially the Mishnah with the possibility that there could be alternative interpretations other than the one that the Bavli offers. We're not going to spend a lot of time on that, but it's often helpful to read the Mishnah with a tabula rasa without knowing what the Bavli is going to say. Of course, it's hard because if you need any commentary on the Mishnah, almost any commentator is going to make use of the Bavli, and frequently if you use the Rabbi Bartanura or almost any of the sort of standard commentaries, they're already going to incorporate the Maskana of the Bavli. The only commentary in the Mishnah that on occasion will sort of ignore the Bavli, only on occasion, is the Rambam. The Rambam. Now, the Rambam in his parish sometimes has a tendency to, you know, not always to pay attention to the Bavli. Most of the time he does, but sometimes he doesn't. There's a famous Tosfos Yontav actually about this issue, about explaining the Mishnah not according to the halacha. Tosfos Yontav is in, I think, Maseches Nazir in the fifth parak. But for the moment, we're going to assume that that the possibility exists. There could be alternative readings of the Mishnah. Of course, the obvious place to look for an alternative reading of the Mishnah is the Yerushalmi. And that should be sort of the most people in the standard base benders don't learn Yerushalmi, so you have no idea, it never occurs to you that could be a completely different way the Amoraim understood the Mishnah. So that's something that we'll deal with. And that, of course, brings me to the next step, is that we do generally Yerushalmi Keseder. There is not a lot of Yerushalmi on this parak. There's not a lot of Yerushalmi on Nezikin. The Yerushalmi on Maseches Nezikin tends to be a little bit different. I'll probably talk about that when we do the first passage in the Yerushalmi, probably next week. I'll give you a brief hakdamah to the Yerushalmi, and I'll talk about some of those issues. But in the meantime, it should be sufficient to say that when we do a sugya, before we do the Bavli, we do the Yerushalmi. The reason I do it that way could be justified in more than one way. The first is chronological, is that the Yerushalmi's redaction probably does precede the Bavli, number one. Number two, the Yerushalmi, from a conceptual perspective, precedes the Bavli, because the Yerushalmi certainly did not have the Bavli. Whether the Bavli had the Yerushalmi or not is a question that's open to debate, but in some cases there are sugyos that the Bavli clearly had the Yerushalmi. Whether it had, as the Rif claims, the entire Yerushalmi is a debatable point, but in that sense, also conceptually, the Yerushalmi takes precedence. Finally, one of the great problems in learning Yerushalmi when you look at some of the Mefarshim is that there's a very strong tendency to try to force the Bavli into the Yerushalmi. You read commentaries like the Pnei Moshe, the Karban Ha'edah, it's often trying to shoehorn the Bavli's interpretation of the Mishnah or things that are stated in the Bavli into the Shachlan Tarya of the Yerushalmi. Sometimes it's a necessary, sometimes it's a good idea, very frequently it's not. This tends to be one of the distinctions between modern scholarship versus more traditional approaches to the Yerushalmi is to what extent do you try to be miyashir the Bavli and the Yerushalmi? It's a continuum. There's no absolutes. Traditional, Rishonim, Achronim recognize that frequently the Bavli and the Yerushalmi do not agree with one another. Sometimes it's simply impossible. There's a question of to what extent does one push in that direction of separating the two, you know, versus being Osa Shalom. My tendency, my general approach is to try to read them separately first. One traditional commentator, very important to know, is the Yefei Naim. The Yefei Naim is printed in the back of the Vilna Shas, and he gives you cross references from the Bavli to the Yerushalmi, to the Midrashei Halacha, to the Midrashei Agada. The Yefei Naim is fairly good about not trying to force the Bavli into the Yerushalmi. If you're trying to find a passage that's not alatar, it's not on the Mishnah, if there's a parallel in the Yerushalmi to what you're doing in the Bavli, the Yefei Naim is the place to look. So we'll have more. We'll do more on the Yerushalmi. After that, of course, we get to the Bavli. That's where we're going to spend most of our time. We will spend a fair amount of time doing Rishonim, but I need to make sort of one thing clear. The way I would formulate it is that the Rishonim are an aid into studying Gemara. The Rishonim are not primarily an end in their own right. Again, we will probably spend the largest amount of time reading Rashbam, Tosfos, Rashba, and the Ran and the like, but nonetheless, my greatest interest in the Rishonim is in how they read the Gemara. And I'm not afraid, it's not going to happen often because they're usually smarter than we are, just because that is the way it is, not because it has to be that way. But occasionally we will have different ways of reading the Gemara. We might offer a different way, and I'm certainly open to some of the things that Pshuto Shel Gemara could be something different. So again, we're going to spend a lot of time in the Rishonim, but it's important not to, from my perspective, not to lose sort of what the focus is or what the goal is in terms of doing those Rishonim. One last thing, generally about Shir. Shir is intended to be interactive. Someone asked me earlier about recording Shir and sending Makoros to someone outside the Shir, and I indicated that I was perfectly happy to do so, but Shir is not often easy to listen to because it's not a frontal presentation. I welcome questions. If you don't ask questions and you don't interrupt and you don't argue with me, then I will learn nothing in Shir. You might learn something, but I'm going to learn nothing. Mitamida yosa mikulam means that I have to learn from you also. And I hope that you will see, and some of you have been here before know that occasionally I believe in the principle of being mevatel daiti etzel datcha, if you can make a better case than I can, and that does happen. So I welcome questions. This is not a frontal presentation. It's too bad for whoever's listening to the recording, that's just the way it is. The shiurim should be available if you missed shiur and you're going to go back and listen to it as opposed to working from somebody's notes. so you should go, the shiurim will be posted on the website. You have access already, AJ? Okay, good. And finally, as far as my availability is concerned, I plan to continue in the future as my practice has been in the past. My presence in the Beis Medrash during morning seder this morning is not an aberration, it is the norm. You should expect me there. I try to be there by 9 o'clock. As some of you might have caught my dry sense of humor, I'm not that funny, even if you do laugh at my jokes. I know that already. My wife tells me not to quit my day job to do stand-up comedy. But you might have caught the little dry humor in the email about traffic jams on Amsterdam Avenue. And there aren't usually too many at the lights, so you should be able to be here by 9 o'clock, even if not. And most of you have been in this year in the past know that I'm usually here pretty close to then. Occasionally, I have other obligations that I have to be at. But I would say 9 out of 10 mornings, I'm there for the morning seder. I'm usually around for lunch. I'll either eat in one of the public areas. Those of you eating lunch with me know I eat a very interesting lunch. those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, you have to see what I eat for lunch. Okay, so Jesse, you're looking with a funny look. Now, I don't eat anything that's wriggling and moving, but you'll see. Some have termed it looks like I eat like for the Pesach Seder at lunch. If you want to meet with me, then I'm usually around pretty much eating lunch every day. You're welcome to sit. I welcome your company. If you need to meet with me privately, my office is sort of somewhere around there. I'm happy to talk to you about issues in Shir, out of Shir. I welcome comments and feedback. One last thing, which is because I'm not doing Yoreh Day this year and all my lunches are available, I'm planning, if there's interest, on resuming doing some type of chabur during lunch. Right now I'm planning to go back and do Targumim, but there might be some more parsha, not just Targum. So if people are interested, I would be happy to hear, just in terms of picking the day that we schedule it on. Tuesday is the only day that's not an option because that's the early Bible day, but Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday are all options, so I'm happy to do it. If there's a very strong interest in something related to Targum or Parshanut, like Ramban or something like that, I would certainly be willing to consider that. Targum is a little easier for me because I don't really have to prepare so much for that. Ramban I would have to prepare, but I'm happy to do so anyway. So if people are interested, one day a week, I'd be happy to do so. So you can offer me suggestions, you can pass them on to me, to AJ, doesn't really matter. So that will be one day a week. It's purely optional, but if you're interested, and often it's the kind of thing you don't have to come every week. If a week you can't come, that's fine as well. So more to be posted when we make a decision on that. Svi?
When you say do Targumim, could you embellish upon that, please?
It means we take Parshas HaShavua and I will pull passages from the Targum that tend to be very interesting. I tend, as much love as I have for grammar, and if you know, when I teach Targumim, it's one of those painful things that you have to swallow because you can't do it properly without it. But during the lunchtime chaburas, I focus more on fun stuff. You know, all those really interesting Targum Yonasans. You know, like, I don't know, Eli Tzafan married Yocheved after Amram divorced her, and then Amram took her back. All those wild things that you find. Lots of interesting. That's not even most fun, but that one came across my plate recently. So anyway, people will let me know if they're interested and if there's a particular day that works better. Also, I guess I should mention now, I'm not sure what the schedule will be in it. There are usually 4 shir events held. They're optional, obviously, at our home. Usually there's a beginning of year barbecue or something. It wasn't a barbecue last year, I think, but and an end of year barbecue, and then Hanukkah and Purim. I'm not sure when the beginning of year event will be. I'm not sure if it's going to be now or wind up being a Simchas Beis HaShoeva or something like that. I'm not sure. But more to come on that. And you are all welcome to come, as well as spouses and significant others. Okay, any questions so far? Simply, you got a smile on your face. I'm sorry?
I'm happy to be here.
Okay, I'm happy you're here. All right. One other thing about Shir. You read. When I'm generally, most of the time I'm nice, but sometimes I can be not nice. The better you are prepared, the more nice I am, and then I let people volunteer to read. By the way, if you have a reading issue and you're really uncomfortable, tell me privately. I'm not interested in making someone do something they're fundamentally uncomfortable with. On the other hand, keep in mind the story that Dr. Lamb tells, or you'll correct me if I have this wrong, about how the Rav once made him read, and he didn't read so well, and he made him read the rest of the year or something like that, and he's forever grateful to the Rav because that's where he learned to read Gemara. Well, is that true, or is that...
He said it never happened, but he likes the story anyway.
But I thought I heard him tell it. Okay. There you go. So maybe it was somebody else. Maybe it wasn't him. Okay. So Kach Shamati, so maybe it has the wrong personality, but I like that. You know, sometimes things never happen, but they're true anyway. Okay. All right, so I do like, I will accept volunteers, especially early on. I do like to go around so that everybody reads, because reading, you know, sort of to tell one anecdote that sort of demonstrates it really well for me. I had a student who I had one year when he was an early admissions freshman, a really bright guy. He's doing a PhD in something at MIT now. And after he went to Eretz Yisrael for a year, I won't say where he learned, he came back and it was in one of the yeshiva's most demanding shir, probably the yeshiva's most demanding shir. And he used to get rides with me all the time. And after he graduated and finished, he told me why he never came back to shir with me. And he said that was because you were going to make me read. So I said to him, how in the world did you get through that shir that you were in? It's the hardest shir in the place. How did you get through it if you couldn't read? He said, my chavrusa did all the reading in chavrusa. And he wasn't really called upon in shir. So I said to him, how'd you get by year with me? So he said, because in high school, his last year, he had learned the same mesechta, the same parak, so he was able to get through it that way. You don't want to be in that situation. So if you haven't already acquired the skills, it's very important to do it. Or a better way of putting it, I don't want to give you a fish. I think you should learn how to fish. With that, may I have a volunteer? Wow. That was an inspirational volunteering. Okay, Moe, go ahead. You'll start. By the way, nobody has to read with that accent, even if it's real, okay? Okay. So, let's translate the things that are listed here. Batim. Okay. Baroshich and Ma'aros. I don't really actually care that you know exactly what each one is. Rashi will tell you they're holes in the ground. Okay. What are their general purpose for, obviously?
Irrigation.
You don't mean irrigation. You mean water storage, right? You want water? What do? You go turn on the tap. By the way, one of my favorite things, some of you know, is the change in realia. Okay, you can also learn very interesting things because you assume that they lived in a world that is similar to ours, but in fact it's quite different than ours. So remember, they didn't go to the tap and turn on the water. They didn't typically have springs. They needed to save their water, collect it from the rain. So Boroshich and Ma'aros were a place to store water. Okay, fine. Ma'ar, I think, was covered on top, dug into the side. Boros and Shichan were open, different shapes. Next, what's a Shovach? Okay, some type of pigeon coop or something like that. What is a merchatz?
Bathing.
A bathhouse. Okay, remember they didn't have bathtubs and showers in their own homes, nor did they have, generally speaking, bathrooms. I mean, there probably was some indoor plumbing in the Roman period, but probably not too many people had that. Beis habadin. What's a beis habad? A press. Now, what is the common denominator, by the way, of all the things in this list? What's that?
Osipiros tadir. They're osipiros tadir.
Correct. Exactly. In other words, they're things that are in constant use. So the chazakah is shaloshanim yom liyom. Now, you have to realize that you have to go back and think about the reality of each of these. Were they really in use the entire year? So the Rishonim here already asked the question. Tosus Yontov quotes both Tosus and Nebuka Yosef, who talk about Beis Abad. When is the olive press in use?
After the olive harvest.
Right, that's not all year long. So I don't care what the answer is right now, and in fact, I don't really care what the answer is, period. It's really the tale doesn't concern me, but the Rishonim grapple with this issue. Next, Beis HaShlachim. What are Beis HaShlachim?
Irrigated fields.
Okay, so Beis HaShlach, Yehuda?
Irrigated fields that don't depend on rain.
Okay, so both of you you're correct. You're adding on a detail. A Beis HaShlachin is a field that doesn't depend upon rain. Rashi gives a strange perush in Moed Katan on the first daf. Rashi says that Beis HaShlachim are on top of the mountains. You have to water them, I think, as opposed to the Beis HaBaal, which is in the valley. Okay. But most of the time, Rashi himself, and I think the generally accepted definition, Beis HaShlachin is something that has to be watered, typically from a spring or some type of irrigation ditch. It has to often be watered in some ways by hand. A Beis HaBaal is watered by rain. Now, what do the terms mean? So Beis HaShlachin, some of you know what I'm going to say already, but Beis HaShlachin, the Gemara Moed gives a perush for each of these. Do not take etymologies that you find in the Gemara as a general rule as being linguistic etymologies. They are often things that border closer to folk etymologies. If you learn the first parak in Ksubos, anybody here learn the first parak in Ksubos? And not skip over those really seemingly an interesting dapim right before Daf Tesem and Aleph is Sveik Sveika. And right before there, the Gemara gives etymologies. The word for door, dasha. You know why a door is called dasha in Aramaic? Derech sham. And you know why a bed is called a puri in Aramaic? Sheparin v'ravin aleh. Those are not linguistic etymologies. They're folk etymologies. So the Gemara Moed Katan says it's called the Beis HaShlachin because it's always thirsty for water. And Rashi points out, and the Gemara says, "Kin mitargaminan v'ata yef yageya." So a yef, I think, is mishalhei, which means thirsty in Aramaic. And Rashi points out, chesen hei, often with the gutturals in Eretz Yisrael especially, but even above all, were very weak, and hei and ches switch all the time. You get drashas like that. That Eila hadvarim, Eila is the lamites malachos. What's the gematria of Eila? 39. Because lo mismanin rabbanin milimikarin lehein ches and leches and hein. That's what the Yerushalmi says. Okay, and Shabbos, right? The hein ches could be interchangeable. They're very, very weak gutturals. So, So that's what the Perush of Beis HaShlachin. Beis HaBal. Okay, I can slip in a little Parshas HaShavua here, test you. What does the term Bu'ulas Baal mean? If you've heard this from me, I don't know if anybody should, you're not allowed to say. What is the term Bu'ulas Baal? Kimatze, it's only, I think, occurs twice in Chumash. Kimatze here, it's Kimatze, Ish Shochevim Isha Bu'ulas Baal, and by Abimelech and Avram, the He Bu'ulas Baal. What does Bu'ulas Baal mean? So you ordinarily would have all jumped with the answer, except for, you know, I'm asking something, I'm setting a snare. Jesse?
A husband who consecrated his marriage.
Consummated, you mean.
Consummated,
right?
Sorry, yeah.
I hope he consecrated it too, but no, consummate. So no, Ba'ulas Baal does not refer to a sexual act. The term Baal doesn't refer to sexual act. A Ba'ulas Baal means husbanded by a husband. Kival Bachor Besula, according to Pshat, I hope nobody of my colleagues in the Bible department disagree, I don't think refers to the act of Bia. The only reference to act of Bia is Ba'el. Ba'alah means, in effect, to take ownership. I know that some people might consider that more offensive by contemporary norms, but that's what Ba'alah means. The opposite of a Ba'ulas Baal, if a woman is a Ba'ulas Baal, what is a husband?
Ba'ulas Baalah.
He's a Baal Isha. In Mishpatim. Those are the two opposite terms, Ba'ulas Baal and Baal Isha. So, anyway, so the Gemara quotes the Pasuk Kival Bachor Besula for Stebes Abal, and the Gemara says, how do you know that Stebes Abal is a Lashon of Miyushav? So they quote the Targum on Kival Bachor Besula Kechma Demitosav, to be Miyushav, to be settled or something like that. That's the way they interpret it. Now, truth be told, it will disturb the conscience of some, but that's probably not what the term Beis Abal comes from. What does the term Beis Abal come from? Chazal probably did not know this, or they probably would not have used the term Beis HaBaal. Now you can already see where I'm going, Moe.
The Canaanite god
Baal. What was the Canaanite god's Baal job? He was the god of fertility. He was the storm god. In Tehillim Samaches, God, our god, Yud-Kei, is the Rochev Aravot. In the Canaanite world, the Rochev Aravot, the rider of the clouds, as Chazal knew Aravot means clouds, not plains like the King James Bible. Aravot, with the rider of the clouds, it means the one who brings the rain. In Ugarit, in among the Canaanites, Baal was the Rochev Aravot. So Baal is the god responsible for fertility, is responsible for rain, and that's probably why it's called a Stebes HaBaal, because the Stebes HaBaal gets its water from the rain, is not watered by people. Okay, by the time Chazal were around, the original meaning was probably totally lost to them. Otherwise, I suspect they might not have used the term. But that's what the word probably originally came from. So bottom line is, a stay beis hashlachin, because you water it, you can water it year-round. Stay beis habal, which depends upon rain, in other words, it's better and it's worse. It's better because, like, asher tizra saracha v'shkisa v'raglacha, asher tizra saracha v'shkisa v'raglacha kegan hayara. So Eretz Yisrael is not like Eretz Mitzrayim, right? Limtar hashamayim tishtemayim. So a stay beis habal has the advantage that you don't have to do any of the heavy lifting of the water. The downside is it only can be used for producing in a limited season of the year, namely when you're going to have rains. When does it rain in Eretz Yisrael? Mar Cheshvan, and then for a few months if you're lucky, or something like that. Emmanuel?
Were different things grown in these different types of fields?
I'm not aware of distinctions.
What?
I don't know. There's a book that I've started reading because some of the agricultural stuff is very confusing. Sort of the big bucky on this, if you want to figure out the agricultural stuff, is Professor Yehuda Felix Zal. And aside from some of you may have encountered his works on Mishnah and Mikra, which is Florin Fon in the Mishnah.
There's also
Magin Brushing. One sec. When's that Tomech Bachai B'Mishnah? Hachai B'Tzah. Tomech v'chai b'mishnah, chai v'tomech b'mikra, b'torah. He only has Torah, but he also has a book on hachaklaut b'mei ha-mikra and b'mei ha-talmud. So he has a book, the library has a few copies, about agriculture through the biblical and rabbinic periods. And if you're trying to figure out how, when they planted things and how they did things, it's actually very, very important.
There are shorter ones in English also. One is by Magen Broshi.
Okay.
Shmuel Safrai, I think, has also a short one on agriculture.
If you could do me a favor, send me the references, then I will forward it to the Shir. Sure. I'd like to see it myself also. It's easy for me to read that way also. I don't know, Emmanuel. I know the answer to that question. Yes.
How long did their boroughs actually hold water for? Because that's kind of reliant on whether or not it's raining anyway. Meaning they weren't getting it from the ocean. relying on the rain to hold the water.
Rain, probably rain and sometimes underground springs. I shouldn't neglect that possibility. So I don't know. It probably depended. If it was dependent only upon rain, you probably filled up in the rainy season. At some point, you ran out.
Right.
Yes, man.
Wells and stuff like that weren't only used for water storage. They were used
they used for
storage.
Other storage as well. I understand. Okay. So that's it. So the Beis HaShlochin, you water it, you can water it year-round, and therefore you can produce crops, let's say, more frequently. Finally, the one odd thing in this list, go ahead, is Avadim. What's odd about Avadim?
They're not natural.
They're not land.
They're not tied to the ground. Now, you all know, probably, Avadim Hukshu LeKarkos. There's a hekesh between Avadim Karkos. But that is probably not what's going on here. When we say Avadim Hukshu LeKarkos, what does that mean?
Placing a get in the hand of an eved.
What's that? That's in the conceptual sense, in a lumder sense, that an eved has a din of karka. But there are things that there are distinctions between karka and metaltalin that are technical distinctions, almost I'll call gzeris akosav, if you'd like. One's a din in karka, one's a din in metaltalin. You don't take a shu on karka, at least min haTorah. No shu on karka. Right? There's no din of kefel on karka. There's no din of liability of shomrim for the most part on karka. But then there are dinim of karka, which maybe are hybrids, or maybe even not. We say karka in an exelis. What does karka in an exelis mean? It may mean, this may be both. I'm sorry?
You can't steal land.
You can't steal land. It's right. You can steal dirt, but you can't steal, there is such thing, you know. But you can't steal land, because what are you going to do? Pick it up and move it somewhere else? I know you know the medrash about Yaakov, ha'aretz atah shochev aleha, so HaKadosh Baruch Hu was mekabel Eretz Yisrael, and then he folded and put it underneath Yaakov, right? Rashi quotes that. But I never really understood what happened to the rest of Eretz Yisrael at the time. You know, was it just the topsoil or what? I don't know. But the bottom line is you can't physically steal karka. But there's a second aspect that could be that there's a din that karka is not an exelis. But then there are things that are just pragmatic, are totally pragmatic. And when it comes to chazakos, the pashtus would be that even if whatever the din of an eved is, an eved is not the inoka karka. You know why? Because an eved can be moved from place to place. Right? It's easy to hide an eved. It's easy to move him where the original owners can't see where he is, don't know where he is. You can't do that with karka. If you want to know if somebody is squatting on your land, what do? You go to your land. If you want, what's that?
You can't just hide a person.
Never came back.
Of course you can. It's done all the time.
They scream.
I mean,
you're human trafficking.
Thanks, Emmanuel. Okay.
Yeah, you steal other people. People know about it. Human trafficking.
Really? What about human trafficking? How many thousands of people do you
think
are being kept?
My family.
Okay. Anyway, I'm glad about that. I prefer to be nobody being kept and captive. But all right.
But the olive press is, is that metaphor also?
I don't think the discussion is not about the. I don't think it's about the kalim. I think it's about the Beis Chabad itself, the fixed part.
Why is that weird? They're still the Paris Tadir, just because usually they're not.
Because they're only one of the things you can anticipate is that part of whatever the exact mechanism, the exact reason, the principle behind Cheska Shalashanim is something to do with the fact that somebody is using the land for 3 years. They don't have proof of ownership. They claim to have bought the land. You taina that it's your land and they had no right to be on it, right? So, and related to the fact is that in some you didn't protest within 3 years. So but you're only going to protest if my field is empty and nobody's using it for 3 years. Nobody gets a chazak on it. Why? Because you don't expect me to say anything. It's my land. So if the Beis Chabad is not in use, why would you expect anybody to say anything? Why would you expect anybody to make a macha? Okay. Fine. So that's the first list in the Mishnah. Now, the Mishnah continues. Skip the Tosefta for just a moment. Sidei, go ahead, Moe. Sidei Abal.
Hizkata, Shalosh Shanim, Ve'inan Miyomiyom.
Okay, so a Sidei Beis Abal is 3 years, but it's not calendar days. In other words, it's three. What does 3 years presumably mean at this point, if you just read the Mishnah? Three crop cycles. Three usage cycles. So three usage cycles is usually going to be 2 years plus some amount, right? And if normally you plant wheat, right after we just plant, I think, right after Yontif, at least in Eretz Yisrael, or in the Mar Cheshvan, or a little bit before Mar Cheshvan, but sort of at that time of year for the next year. It's generally, I think, a winter wheat crop. So, you know, we plant it in Mar Cheshvan. It will sit in the ground through the winter, start to sprout at some point, and eventually it'll be harvested sometime during Sfira. It's wheat, right? And by the time you gather the wheat in, it will be, you know, before Chag HaSukkah somewhere. So there's probably a month gap in which between when you finish processing the wheat and the planting. So in that case, if you had a chazakah of shalosh shanim, but it were not miyom liyom, it would be 2 years and 11 months or something like that. Other crops, barley would be a little bit shorter because barley is harvested earlier and probably finished a little earlier. Whatever it is, it's something less than 3 years, but it's 2 years plus. Comes along, Rabbi Yishmael says,
Rabbi Yishmael lomed, Shosha chadashim barishana, Shosha b'achrona, Hashem asa chadash b'ayim, Sa'ar harei yudhat chadash.
Okay. And Rabbi Akiva Omer?
Rabbi Akiva Omer, Chadash Barishana, Chadash Bachana, Yudbet Chadash Ba'im, Sa'ar Yudav Chadash.
Okay, now, two questions here. Firstly, what is the relationship between Stay Abal, Cheskasa Shaloshanim, Ve'ena Miyom Liyom, and then Rabbi Yishmael, Rabbi Akiva? This is an important Machlokas HaRishonim. It's a textual question, for starters. What are the choices here, how to read the relationship? There are two ways of reading it. I can formulate, they're arguing, what's that? They're arguing?
Either they're arguing and there's a Tanakhama, or they're interpreting that phrase.
So the question is, how many opinions are recorded in the Mishnah? Are there two opinions interpreting the first line, or are there actually three opinions? So this is an issue that the Rishonim are going to argue about, and there may be, potentially there's a nafkamin halacha lemaisa, actually. It's not a nafkamin in terms of how you read the Mishnah, but it's a machlokas, what Rav and Shmuel are talking about later in the Gemara, and it may affect in terms of how we paskim. Ultimately, it's going to boil down to whether there are actually total three or four opinions. There's certainly in the Mishnah that are more than three, but there may be a fourth opinion somewhere, and that will depend upon whether or not that fourth opinion really is the Tanakhama here, or there is no Tanakhama here. In effect, it's... Okay. Simcha? Question? Okay. Now that brings us, of course, to the Tosefta.
Okay.
Yes?
Is it possible that they're commenting on the entire Mishnah, not just on the Tehabal? They're saying that...
That seems unlikely, right? In other words, look, Pshuto Shel Mishnah, what would you say they're doing? Are they qualifying or arguing? They're qualifying. That's really what it very much sounds like it. In other words, this is the basic principle. Stay abal cheskas shalosh shanim ve'ena miyom liyom. Okay, but what does that mean? So Rabbi Yishmael Omer, shlosh chadashim, Rabbi Akiva Omer, chodesh echad. That's the simple way of reading it. Now, the question is there any way of proving that, though? Is there any way of proving it? And here's where the Tosefta becomes interesting. Here, we're going to have to spend a few minutes. What is the Tosefta? So the Tosefta is a collection of brisos, which have some relationship to the Mishnah, most of the time, but not all the time. There is material in the Tosefta that very clearly is a commentary on the Mishnah. In fact, sometimes Tosefta, if you try to read Tosefta on its own, is almost impossible, because frequently you get like five words and they seem to make absolutely no sense. It's like the sentences don't even read together, because you have to know, you have to put in your own periods. And then Tosefta has like shifted gears like that. It's not so hard to read Mishnah that way. The Mishnah is a fully formed document, and you can read straight through. Tosefta you often cannot do that on. There is material in Tosefta, however, which has nothing to do with the Mishnah, or it's tangentially related, but it's independent. And then there's material in Tosefta which will quote the Mishnah, elaborate upon it. There's even sometimes material in Tosefta which may predate the Mishnah. That's a question. It's a major debate now among scholars as to whether or not the Tosefta contains any of the earlier versions of the Mishnah. Not my interest right now. Every passage in the Tosefta you sort of have to relate to on its own terms and just read what it is and understand what it's doing. Now, one of the tricky parts, there's one very major complicating factor when you're going to read the Tosefta very carefully now. And that is the following. What was in the Mishnah at the time the Tosefta was written? Let me just give you one example from later. Some of you may have noticed but may not have thought about it. You notice that, did any of you get to the Tosefta about Edom Zomimim on that Mishnah? I don't know if anybody got there, but if you got there, you noticed the Tosefta was out of order? You didn't notice because I rearranged it for you if you were using my sheets. But if you look at the numbering system, you'll find that the Tosefta in some places is out of order. Why is the Tosefta out of order? Why would the Tosefta be out of order?
It's just in a different order.
Out of what order?
Out of order of the Mishnah.
Someone put the Mishnah in one order and didn't touch the Tosefta.
So one possibility, this doesn't there are many possibilities, could be a scribe's error, but one possibility is that the Bala Tosefta had a different order in the Mishnah in front of him. So let me spill another little secret. Sometimes the Bala Tosefta had a different Mishnah in front of him. Sometimes he had a different text. It's an issue that we're not going to explore very much, but there are frequently occasions you can tell from the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, one or the other, you can tell that the Amoraim had a different text in the Mishnah than we have in front of us. Sometimes, in fact, our Mishnah text was edited by somebody or changed by somebody to match the Maskan of the Bavli or the Yerushalmi. There are some very well, some of these, by the way, survive in the Kisveyad. Rishonim will point this out frequently that this comes up, where you see from the Gemara that certain words were actually not in their Mishnah. Okay, sometimes you have manuscript evidence to it, sometimes you don't, but you still know the Amoraim had a different Mishnah in front of them. They were missing something in the Mishnah. Sometimes the Tosefta may also be a product of that. So when you're going to try to figure out what the Tosefta is saying about the Mishnah, keep in mind the remote possibility that the Tosefta had a different text than the Mishnah in front of it. That said, assuming the default assumption is that it had the text of our Mishnah in front of it, what does it mean when, what do you do when the Tosefta seems just to repeat the Mishnah? So the answer is you scratch your head. Why is the Tosefta just repeating the Mishnah? So you have to read very carefully to see, is the Tosefta really just repeating the Mishnah, or is the Tosefta adding a little bit of a twist? It's very, very important. It's a point that you'll miss sometimes the meaning of what the Tosefta is adding if you don't look really, really carefully. So look at this Tosefta for a moment. And what does the Tosefta say? Maui, go ahead.
Kol she'eno ose ferot tadir, kigon sadeh, beta shelachin, beta ba'al, hatkata shelosh shanim, ve'ena miyom liyom.
Okay. So, you don't have to read any, or where are you going now? Are you going to the next? Oh, you're reading out of the Tosefta.
Yeah.
Okay, that's the part that's relevant to our Mishnah. What is added here?
Beta shelachin is...
Well, you have base hashlachin in there.
Yeah.
No, okay. So the
give us the thing on the bottom. So
the good Lieberman at least. The text that I printed you is from the Bar Ilan. The Bar Ilan. So let me step back one more brief moment. Text and Perush Shema and the Tosefta. The Tosefta in the back of the Vilna Shas probably qualifies for federal disaster aid. It's really really bad shape. The text has been so much edited and often leveled to the Bavli that it looks in many ways, so many ways different than what the Tosefta text is supposed to be. If you actually go back to the Kisvei Yad of the Tosefta, and we only have two, we don't have two complete ones, but one of them is Ksaviat Vienna, which is complete, and the other one is Ksaviat Erfurt, which goes from the beginning of Shas till somewhere in Zvachim. So the Tosefta manuscripts often look very different than what you find in the back. And that's because they weren't edited the same way. They weren't edited often leveled towards what the Bavli has, because the Bavli doesn't have all the Toseftas, but it has a lot of Toseftas, but frequently there are shinui neschos in the Bavli. I don't mean shinui neschos of spellings, but I mean substantive differences that whatever you do with those but are not in the Kisvei Yad of the Tosefta. Most of the time, the Tosefta will look much closer to, if you have the Braisa in the Yerushalmi, will look much closer to what you find in the Yerushalmi, which would suggest that the original version, in fact, is probably closer to that, but I'm not going to go into that now. Now, in terms of addition, what do you do then for the Tosefta? How do you get a good addition? So there are only two good editions of the Tosefta in terms of a reliable text. The first one was put out by a German Rav in the 19th century, Shlomo Zucker Mandel. It's very hard to find it. It's one fat volume. I have not seen it in print in many years, but it's the entire Tosefta. And basically, he worked under very hard conditions, and given those conditions, he did a remarkable job. There are some important errors in it, but nonetheless, it's probably the best single-volume edition you can get of the Tosefta. Professor Lieberman also worked on Tosefta more extensively, and his edition is far better. He only got through Maseches Bava Basra. Now, there's one we will have. Did you guys steal the Tosefta Kapshut already? What? Oh, that was lunchtime's project. Yeah, well, I'll bring over the Tosefta from the other base medrash and put it, you know, near our makom. There's only one there, but if you're interested at least in the text of Tosefta, so the Bar Ilan text uses, and it's available through the library, you can get it, if you're logged in through here, you can get it online, and you don't have to even be in the library. So the Bar Ilan text uses Lieberman where available, which is through Maseches Bava Basra. Bava Basra was the Bavas were published posthumously. Lieberman died before he completely finished them, but it's a but the text is available on the Bar Ilan CD. After that, it's Zucker Mandel's edition. So it's a very good text. Basically, what you have in the Bar Ilan is the best text you'll have available. When I send you text, they'll have that. Most of you should have access to that. So that's the place to look. Commentaries on the Tosefta. In the back is something of a mishmash. There's nothing very good in the back. Even that which was good was abridged by the printers. There's an important parish by Rav David Pardo, I think 17th century, called the Chasdei David. What they did in the back to the Chasdei David was a sharuria. They destroyed it and mangled it and abridged it, and it's a disaster. It has been reprinted. It's printed like in a 10-volume set. I'm sure the library has it. That's one useful parish. A second useful parish on the Tosefta was by a Gaon of Yecheskel Abramsky, known as the Chazon Yecheskel. I don't know if this base medrash, the other base medrash, at least, I'm pretty sure, certainly has the Chazon Yecheskel. I don't know if it has the Chasdei David. If you really need, I have a Chazon Yecheskel in my office, which will soon be there. And the third parish, the one which I prefer, but that obviously speaks to my interest in terms of Peshat, is Tosefta Kepshuta, which is Lieberman's commentary on the Tosefta. And I refer to him as Professor Lieberman. I usually do. For anybody who's wondering or aware of the politics, I have enormous esteem and respect for Rochelle Lieberman. Professor Lieberman is just usually how he's often referred to, and it's not a polemical statement, as he's referred to as professor as opposed to Rav. And if some people are offended, I don't know if anybody's offended by it, but there's no political implications in that statement for anybody who wants to walk away with it. He was a gonotzum. He had enormous bekias and charifus, but he was very much pshat-oriented. And so I find the Tosefta Kepshuta to be one of the most, firstly, it's enormous in terms of just Mar Makomos, because like he knew everything. So if you want to know wherever anything you're looking for is there. He also, by the way, published much earlier, and he changed some things, but when he did Tosefta Kepshuta, but in the late 40s, he published something called Tosefes Rishonim. It's two volumes. One is in the first five Siddur, and the other is in Taros, of where Rishonim quote the Tosefta's and what they do with it. I mean, again, Bikias was just Bikias Atsuma. It was unbelievable. So it's called Tosefes Rishonim. The library will have, the library also has both of these works. So we'll have a Tosefta Kepshuta probably by tomorrow in our base medrash if you're interested in looking at it. Okay, so coming back to our Tosefta, and Lieberman actually talks about this passage, but I'm not sure, I'm not convinced that he's correct, but you can decide for yourself. What does this Tosefta add to our Mishnah? Yehuda? Okay. So what does that do?
What it does is, if you didn't have the Tosefta and only the Mishnah in front of you, you could say the Sadeh HaBaal, any Miyom Miyom, has nothing to do with the fact that it's Osetavir or not.
That's true, although it would be pretty odd, that'd be the obvious interpretation anyway. In other words, you'd be really stretching. What else does it do? Yaakov?
It's creating two different categories. It sounds like a literary thing.
Yeah, in other words, it really fragments the Mishnah into two. It's a heading. It turns Stebes HaBaal, it turns that line from a specific example into a heading. And if it turns it into a heading, what does that then imply for the question we asked about the continuation of Rabbi Yishmael Rabbi Akiva? It's not 100% mukhrach, but it certainly suggests something. Jesse?
If it changes to another heading, then that would be
Adarabba. It would be a heading, a topic. In other words, Kol she'enos appears tadikum, she'esavach eskasas v'shalom shanim ve'enam yom liyom. That's a heading. Are now arguing what is the nature of that enemy only own?
Okay.
Yeah, Michael?
Although they could still be arguing against the Tanakhama that this is the...
I'm not willing to say Behechreach that it has to be right that way, but I think that is the simpler way, a simpler way of reading it once you turn it into a heading. Which tells you only, it only tells you one thing, by the way. What does it tell you? Let's assume that I'm correct about the Tosefta. Going back to a comment I made earlier, what does that tell you about the Mishnah? Nothing. What does it tell you? It tells you how the Bala Tosefta read the Mishnah. This is a very important point. There could be a different reading of the Mishnah other than that which the Baal Tosefta offers. Note, however, it's a little dangerous proposing that. I'm much more comfortable proposing an alternative reading of the Mishnah, an alternative to the Bavli, or even an alternative to the Yerushalmi. I'm much more reluctant to offer an alternative reading to the Tosefta, because the closer you go back to the original source, and the Tosefta's redaction is within a generation of the Mishnah, the more likely the interpretation reflects original intent. The more likely it is Mesorah as opposed to interpretation. So does it mean that there can't be an alternative interpretation of Tosefta? There certainly can be, but it is less likely. The closer you go to the original source, the more likely it is that it's going to be the original intent of that particular source. So, okay, fine. Yes?
I don't get why, you know, adding those four words really helps. Can it still be a Tanakama? You know,
I'm not telling you it's impossible, but by setting it up as a new half of the Mishnah...
It's just been parallel to the other
half. No, you see, the way it's presented in the first way is you have the first half, and then that's the general, that tells you the rule of all these things, and then, but something like Shtei Beis Abal, it's Cheska Shalashonim, but it's not Miyom Liyom. So Shtei Beis Abal, it's Cheska Shalashonim, in a Miyom Liyom. Sounds like a Shtei Beis Abal, it's a Chazak for 3 years, but not 3 full years. Rabbi Shmuel now says, no, it's not even 3 years, it's really just 18 months. Rabbi Akiva says it's just 14 months. It's harder to do that when you start out by saying that kol she'ena osa tadir kigon stei beis abal cheskasa shalasham meyom yom. That's a general rule. That stei beis abal was just an example thrown in there. The focus of the second half of the Mishnah is no longer on stei beis abal. It's giving you a general category of things that are shalasham ve'ena meyom liyom. Now, Rabbi Yishmael comes along, and it's hard to imagine Rabbi Yishmael coming along and saying that all things that are ena osa peyos tadir are 18 months. Are all things where Akiva says are 14 months?
So you're saying if you don't have the Tosefta, they're just arguing about Sadeh Habal?
So they're arguing just about Shtei Beis Habal. Either way, they're going to be arguing about Shtei Beis Habal. But if you have it the way the Mishnah reads it, all that's there in the Tanakhama is the Shtei Beis Habal. So it really could more plausibly be argued, not compellingly as three opinions, but once you present it as a Hakdama, it's really now two balanced halves of the Mishnah. It becomes less, not impossible, but less likely that you're dealing with three opinions, but rather two opinions elaborating or debating what one particular opinion held. Yaakov?
Does it make more sense just in terms of the beginning of the Mishnah to include the Kalal thinking and the two would also be parallel? So instead of starting with Chesed Kabbat, you should have started with Kosher's Paris, Tadir, with Sashim Shalashar, and then followed with the examples?
You know, so you're now asking about... I'll give you a clever answer. There's no way of knowing what literarily motivated the Tana to formulate something one way or the other, but I will throw out the following. And this isn't always true, but I suspect it's more frequently true than not true. The style of Mishnaic learning is case law or conceptual?
Case law.
Things that... I would never posit this as a general statement because it's going out on a limb that's too thin, but my instinct sometimes would be is that when you find details in the Mishnah and you find the klal, is that, again, it's hard to see layers in the Mishnah, but to the extent that you can, the klal is later than the details. And therefore, one could argue, but again, this is just speculation, that the Mishnah presents it, and Chol She'osef Peres Tadir is a later layer in the Mishnah. There's no evidence to saying that. I'm just saying, hypothetically, that's why you might get such a formulation, even if it's one Tana, because you go from case law to conceptual. Okay.
Doing that, right?
Okay.
You said it was.
Interpreting the Mishnah that way, yeah.
Yeah, so then could you still say that that's the original intent?
Yes. Correct. In other words, the Tosefta doesn't prove that that's the original intent of the Mishnah. It's just more, given if the Tosefta read the Mishnah that way, read Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shmuel presumably that way, that's presumably what they meant. You know, what was being meant by the Tana Mishnah. Must it be? No, but it's more likely. Vitaly, any questions? Okay, fine. So let's continue. One other issue. Yeah, Avshe Simcha.
I was just saying to build off. I think what we were saying. I think the Mishnah itself is not as generalized as the Tosefta is trying to make it, and that the kosher was and peyotadir is first of all could be a more specific thing in and of itself, which is not to include the things beforehand. And second of all, I'm not even sure if necessarily has to mean fruits as opposed to
usufruct, usage. That's all. You know,
I think we're reading in light of the mission, in light of the Tosefta, which is that the whole thing is basically about what's Tadir, what's not Tadir. Why are we doing that?
Well, I think it's out, even when, without the Tosefta, let me ask you a question. Without the Tosefta, you read the first half of the Mishnah. Now you read Steh Abal Cheskasa Shalashem Ein Liyom. Why?
No idea.
Oh, come on.
I have no idea.
Why you have no idea? The Mishnah gave you a reason in the first half. The reason why Cheskasa Shalashem Miyom Liyom is because it's Oseh Peiros Tadir. You have a Steh Abal, which is not used during the agricultural year, the full year. It's only used 9 months, 8 months, 10 months. So, I mean, it's a little mean nihilistic to say I wouldn't have known what the reason was. What? No. You can't ask me from Beis Abadim because Beis Abadim is clearly used Tadir. The question you're asking is that really so? But the Mishnah says it's so. You can't ask the question.
It's an
awesome
simplest
thing.
Question
of
this connects. I don't know
how they connect.
Which vav? No, it's going to be an and either way. But given the contrast between Beis Hashlachan and Beis Habal, why would you think that Oseh Peiros Tadir isn't in fact a tlal that's describing everything that's being used there? Those are all. Let me ask you a question. Are Baruchichim, are Merchatzos, are Shovachos, Baruchichim Maris, are Batim, are they not Oseh Peiros Tadir? What's that? What, your chicken coop?
Yeah.
No, they're only used when you need the water.
I don't know.
Yeah, we should eat every day.
They're used for storage on a regular basis.
Regular
Vatim are used.
There's no period of the year that they're not used.
What's that?
There's no period of the year
that anything in the first part of Mishnah is not used. I think that Beis Hashlochen, this, by the way, the kind of argument that I like to have. In this case, Simcha's wrong, but sometimes I'll be wrong. But Beis Hashlochen, the contrast between.
The whole season thing in the Mishnah either, just for that.
So you don't? That's just the reality of that's the reality of the world.
I understand that's actually how the world functions.
Everywhere the
that's the one norm that the Mishnah is functioning.
I think throughout rabbinic literature, Beis Hashlach and Beis Habal, I think that's pretty clear.
Alright, it's not as clear as the Tosefta wants it to be.
Okay. So anyway, so bottom line is that's an issue that we'll still have to deal with. Now let's finish the Mishnah. I'm a Rabbi Yishmael. What's a Sde Lavan? What's a Sde Lavan?
The perot are
grain.
Grain.
I don't know if it's related to Malbano Sheltua or because it may give the appearance of being very light colored, but I'm not really. I assume it's the latter, but you never know.
Just grain, not
wheat? Wheat was the. Probably. Since. Barley was not the first choice grain. I suspect that they planted more wheat. But I suspect that a Sde Lavan could also be other types of cereal grains. That'd be my guess. Okay? Aval Sde Ilan.
Aval Sde Ilan. Kanaset Tuato, Masaket Zitav, Kanaset Kaito, Ari Elo Shalosh Shanim.
Okay, so there are a couple of issues here. So Rabbi Yishmael apparently felt it could be even less than 18 months. This could be all in the course of a year. When do you gather in the grain? When do you harvest the grain? Starting before Pesach with the earlier crops, going through the Omer around to Shavuos time. When do you gather in the olives?
Sometime between Elul and Hanukkah-ish.
Yes, later in the season. When do you cut the, what are kayata?
The figs.
Figs. When do you cut the figs?
Summer.
Before the summer. What do you do with them during the summer? You dry them, right? The order is a little bit odd. So that the Rishonim deal with. Okay. But there's a more important conceptual question.
Why is this Shalashanim?
What's that?
Why is this Shalashanim?
It's not Shalashanim.
Why is it considered
Shalashanim? So let me ask the question. How do you envision this field being laid out? This is so easy to miss, actually, and I only realize this because the Gemara doesn't even say what it's doing. But here's, if you don't realize the Gemara is a parish on the Mishnah, when you get this Gemara, you might forget what we say now, and then when we get to the Gemara, then you'll sort of wake up again about this. How do you envision this field? Can I, any artists here?
The Elon, said that Elon?
No, can I get an artist here? You don't have to be an artist. I just want someone to go up and draw on the board. for me. I need a sacrificial lamb.
I'll draw.
Go ahead. Okay.
Artist, but whatever. Mark is on this side also.
Okay. Here is a field. Okay. Let's say A, B, and C are your three kinds of trees. Can you tell me how they're laid out? We have figs, we have olives, and we have. No, tvoso is not grain. Tvoso is wise grapes. And that's what makes it more complicated. It's grapes. Tvos akerem, this week's parasha. It's clear it's not, because grains...
That's Sedelavan.
That's Sedelavan, okay? So we have grapes, olives, and figs. You can G, O, and F, okay, if you like it that way. Lay out, let's say, we have five of each of these trees. 10 would be better to see while we get to the Gemara eventually. It's going to be a few months. But G, O, and F, okay? Lay out... Give me five trees of each one.
Obviously, that I'm missing. I guess I don't know.
Everybody else is missing. Everybody else is missing it too. Go ahead.
Why is the mission
unnecessary? Wait. So Jesse asked a good question. Why am I assuming it's in one field? Okay, so I'm going to make the alternative. Okay. All right. So this is what I want to say, which is olive. Sorry, it's not a slide. Okay. Great. Okay. So let's assume I put a fence between each one. Okay. So. Goff? No.
I said it's so cool that your trees look exactly like a letter.
Excuse me? Excuse me? Did you just somebody say Kilayim? There's no Kilayim by trees unless you graft them. Kilayim Karim requires grains or vegetables. Okay. Anyway, by the way, those of you who don't know, I have a little pet peeve. I think it's a good thing to know Chumash and Rashi and Mishnah. It's just a little thing that I have. So you might hear about it a few times during the year for me. You should be doing Shnayim Mikavecha Targum, and it's a good thing to know Mishnayos. Anyway, why can't... Is this what the Mishnah is talking about? Why not?
Is this not what they used to do?
No. I could have three fields next to each other. I mean, I'm exactly how they laid it out. Why is this ridiculous?
Because those are three different fields?
They're three different fields! So if I do this one in January, and this one in March, and this one in May, why do I have a cheska shalosh shanim, or cheska shalosh crops, on one field? Now, one of the obvious questions you have to ask is, what defines something as a field? You have sacrificed for the cause, fine.
Wait, so
I left you with a blank slate. You see, I would rather say, the Gemara is going to say something like this, that, you know, okay, now you don't have to do the drawing, you know, figs, grape. You get the idea. Right? Now, what's interesting about this field, what? I have no idea.
The Mishnah and...
I don't know. I don't care. Let's forget what the maskan is. I just want to highlight, for you the question of what defines a sadeh. If I have two houses and I get a chazak on one and I live, you know, the two of us, okay, you know, my wife and I, and we like our own space, so we live in two houses next to each other, they have doors in between, and I live in one and she lives in the other, but I live in one for a year and a half, she lives in the other for a year and a half, they're not mitzuraf, right? In other words, it has to be one entity that I demonstrate ownership on for 3 years. How is this one entity? So
maybe those are a lot of little fields. I mean,
what?
Maybe those are a lot of little fields.
So when the answer could be is that...
There's one big fence around all three.
Who says there are fences?
What's that?
And who says the fence of that type makes a difference?
So this is a very, very important question. It's going to come up a couple of places in the parak. It's important conceptually is, what is defined as a sadeh halachically? Now, I presume it's fundamentally a balabatish definition, meaning it's a metzias definition, but that's an important question. The Gemara is going to talk about a metzar border between fields, but this is a very important issue. But the Mishnah should already beg the question, what type of a field are we talking about? The Gemara is going to walk away from this Mishnah with a very, very important yesod about a field with scattered trees and you only eat some of them and so on. I read the Gemara, and I found it to be a confusing Gemara, and I found it to be a puzzling Gemara, and only later, going back over it, did I realize that the Mishnah itself begs the question, what are these three fields? It has to be one field with three products in it that are harvested at different times, somehow, and that's enough to constitute three crops on one field. Okay, but someone asked, who does this? I don't know. I would have thought that it's more convenient to plant these things. But, you know, maybe Felix will talk about it, or somebody talks about this.
Mishnah Pei talks about, you know, switching off rows, and I think Kahati there says, because if you put two trees together, you know, you lose the space under them because of the canopies, so in between they would plant another crop.
Okay, so it could be it's rows, individual rows. That might be the case. Okay. Emmanuel?
I mean, I don't know exactly how...
So I'll just tell you, by the way, when you read the Gemara description of Rishonim, it sounds like the example the Gemara talks about is not on the fruit trees themselves, but talks about Mefuzaros. Maybe that would be, you know, Mefuzaros to me always struck me, you know, like Eser, the name of Eser Netios, Mefuzaros doesn't mean in rows, and Mefuzaros means really spread out, but you might be correct, that might be what the Mishnah's case is. Okay, but then again, I'm going to ask you the follow-up question, which is, if I have rows, OGF, OGF, what defines, you still have to define what makes it one field. Okay, but in other words, what is the boundary? How do you know that it's not one field of O, one field of G, one field of F?
Same thing if you scatter them all around.
No, because when I scatter them all around, if I've got, you know, a tree on this side, and this side of each kind, and I harvest them, I've harvested sort of from the entire area. I didn't harvest the entire area, but I've taken from the entire area. If you were to, you know, play connected dots, you'd have almost the same looking field, no matter which crop you took. That's the Gemara's discussion of Fuzara sounds like that, but you might be right. Emmanuel? For the last three questions, we'll stop in Dava Mincha. Emmanuel, Rafi, and Jesse.
I still don't understand what Chazaka is. Is it using a piece of land, like in one case for 3 years, or is it getting three things from a field? Because let's say I'm in a house, like that's one of the cases, right? And I live in it for 3 years, right? Those aren't three separate things. Those are one separate thing, and I just define this artificial set of time as 3 years. Crops aren't an artificial thing. You get one crop, then...
Yes, but... A little bit later, so it's a good question. I think the answer to that question is that psychologically speaking, years are real things for people. They are in terms of nature also. Solar years are real. And years aren't. But bottom line is, a lot of what's going on in the Cheska Shalashanim has to do with human psychology and when a person, you know, feels that their rights are being trampled upon. So since we tend to look at, you know, things, we rent a house, typically. We rent an apartment. What is the standard unit in which you rent it?
Time.
What unit of time?
Year.
A year. Okay, in other words, it doesn't have to be that way, but it is. So in that sense, using a house for 3 years does, in most people's mind, represent three units. That's so, just the way people work.
So Chazaka is getting three things,
three units of usage. Yeah. Okay. Rafi? Jesse, and that's...
Just in terms of this question that we're dealing with here, maybe based on their proximity, it's clear that whoever owns one of the fields is the owner of the other ones as well, and therefore we can look at them as a unit, even if they're divided as they are on the left side of the board.
Well, but it only would be obvious if it looks like one field. Now, I agree with you fundamentally, but a fence could do the trick. There are all sorts of ways, but how would you know?
I mean, I would think that perhaps, like, even if there is a fence, that... If they're right next to each other, that close, it's likely to assume that it's the same owner, even if there's a fence between. I don't know. I don't know if it's a fair assumption or not.
It's all related.
Okay, Justin.
I mean, just continuing on this point, it would even seem more confusing if you had the trees scattered on another field, because you're seeing someone picking from random spots in a place full of trees. You know, picking fruits. It doesn't mean that. You
so
know,
the answer to that question is. That when someone goes through and clear cuts all the olives, and as you see what he's doing, it's not that, in other words, one of the points that we made in the Gemara and the Rishonim is that if you have them all producing fruit at the same time and ready at the same time, then that's no good to take Mefuzaros, because then why are you only picking some and not the others? But if it's obvious why you're picking some and not the others, then that would be an issue. Okay, we'll eventually get to deal with this. It may be a while before we see the Gemara. You can like its solution, not like its solution, but you realize when you look at the Mishnah, you have to define what is a field. And as Yehuda.
Just quickly, this whole discussion is the assumption that
AJ?
Harvesting is really the definition of what field is, which
to, I could have, when it comes to trees, for the most part, it's generally speaking, in a given year, it is harvesting. Because
no, I mean,
and you can do